455. The Chief Justice Pippen is with us via video in Las Vegas, and we, Justice Hardesty and I, may not be visible on the transmission on the podcast, but obviously we are being heard and properly recorded. So with that, are the parties ready to proceed?
Yeah.
Very well. Mr. Kaufman?
Justices, may it please the Court, Keith Kaufman on behalf of Appellant Audie Leventhal. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for my rebuttal, please. This appeal concerns an improper granting and adjudication of a charging lien under NRS 18.015 in the District Court. Initially, my client the Labella law firm to finalize a divorce. That divorce decree was entered in May of 2010. Thereafter, months later, a custody dispute arose, and the parties continued to litigate only the custody part. All the fees relating to the divorce action were paid. The matter concerning the custody issues settled by stipulation and order on January 7th, 2011. The Labella firm withdrew voluntarily, then filed, without telling my client, and then filed a motion to adjudicate a charging lien. In that motion, they contained a notice of lien. However, they did not mail the notice of lien and the motion until the next day, the 28th. That notice was invalid as well. Given the lengthy briefing on this appeal, I'd like to emphasize four major points in my oral argument. First, the notice of lien and motion to adjudicate were never served in strict compliance as required under NRS 18.015. Second, the underlying custody dispute involved no proceeds nor monetary damages to attach. Third, Labella did not have standing under 18.015 to file its motion to adjudicate because it never had the prerequisite perfected charging lien. And four, Labella was ineligible for a charging lien because it voluntarily withdrew after settlement on January 7th and prior to any attempted service of the notice of lien. In Argentina case, this court provided that absent an enforceable charging lien or the client's consent, the district court is without jurisdiction to adjudicate an attorney-client fee dispute in the underlying action. An attorney perfects a charging lien by strictly complying with the lien statute NRS 18.015. My first point is that notice was never perfected for the charging lien, and it was never served in strict compliance upon Mr. Leventhal. Subsection 2 of 18.015 provides that an attorney perfects the lien by serving notice in writing, certified mail, return receipt requested. That was never done in this case. Labella acknowledges in its stipulation on January 7th, which it filed in court, that Mr. Leventhal's residence, current residence, was Utah. However, they didn't mail the notice of lien or the motion to Utah, and never to a Las Vegas property. Prohibition Guard case held that a return receipt card is required because NRS 18.015 is strictly construed. No proof of return receipt exists here. My second point I'd like to emphasize, Your Honors, is that no affirmative proceeds to attach the lien were present in the custody dispute. Subsection 3 of 18.015 provides that the lien attaches from the time of service of the notices required in this section. Because the service of the notice of lien was never valid, there's no possibility of a charging lien. This was a custody dispute. The lien was the last lien to be filed, essentially. After Lovello had settled, after they withdrew, and after they even filed a motion. So no affirmative proceeds were recovered or existed at the time. My third point of emphasis is that Lovello had no standing to file a motion to adjudicate. As I stated, well, in subsection 4 of 18.015, it provides that an attorney having a lien may file a motion. The having in the text of subsection 4 denotes present tense requirement. The Bellafin filed their motion and lien on the 27th. When they filed that motion, they did not have a lien because they had never even attempted to mail the notice of lien. They didn't mail that motion until the next day, the 28th, and then they mailed it to the Las Vegas property, not my client's legal residence. Therefore, notice was invalid for improper service. Number four point I'd like to emphasize is that Lovello's voluntary withdrawal made it ineligible for a charging lien. Lovello voluntarily withdrew after settlement. It did not tell my client that it was withdrawing. It withdrew after the close of the case, and prior to any notice of lien, the case was over. And my client had no legal counsel because they withdrew. I'd just like to touch upon a couple other bases that were in my brief. In this case, my client, upon receiving the statement of fees, which is in dispute, about January 5th, notified Lovello that they dispute those fees and that they believe that they were negligent in their legal work and that it was improper. And he asserted malpractice claims. He asked for time to review the issues. Our contender instructs that because of Lovello Leventhal was asserting a malpractice claim, it was improper for a district court to adjudicate the claim lien. Also, the district court, when holding the hearing on the motion to adjudicate the lien, was never provided any billing statements. No hours were stated as to what the fees pertained to, and no descriptions of any work were described. Like Argentina, the order states in a conclusory fashion the fees and costs requested were necessary and reasonable as outlined in their motion. The court order, which the court signed that day, February 25th, 2011, was pre-drafted by Lovello prior to the hearing, and it was signed very quickly, within probably seconds, based on the transcript. There was no discussion of Blenzel factors in that hearing. Lovello has admitted that these fees were only for 1 month of work. Everything else had been paid the last month prior to settlement. To amass that amount of fees, an attorney probably would have had to work every single day for the entire month, 8 hours a day, and this be their sole project. There just wasn't anything that amounts to that kind of work in need. Thus, based on the briefs and oral argument, Appellant Leventhal respectfully requests that the district court orders be vacated.
Mr. Kaufman, could you clarify a couple of dates for me? I understand the stipulation was entered into on January 7th.
Yes.
Was there a written order contemporaneous with that or following that?
I'm sorry, can you...
Was there a written order contemporaneously with January 7th?
There was. It was a stipulation and order, Your Honor. And that was entered on the 7th, I believe. Yes, filed in open court January 7th, 2011, stipulation and order. And it states right there on Appellant's Appendix 77 that Audie is currently a resident of the state of Utah, the parties acknowledge. And that was approximately 2 weeks before the motion and the lien.
Do you maintain that one cannot assert a charging lien in a divorce case where the results are that one of the parties has a substantial portion of their or all of their separate property confirmed to them when that property is in dispute?
Yes, Your Honor, if I could clarify based on the cases. In Argentina, there was no proceeds to attach at the time that the notice of lien occurred. In this case, likewise, the divorce dealt with all any of the separate property, and in fact, my client merely in his counterclaim, I think it was more of an affirmative defense, just stated, no, there's a premarital agreement, and we should abide by the premarital agreement. He admitted that there was a premarital agreement. What he objected to, there were custody issues in the complaint. So really, all of them were battling were custody issues, Your Honor. And there were no proceeds dealt with in custody issues. Moreover, there were no, all the bills relating to the divorce had already been paid.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Lavella?
Thank you. Michelle Lavella, obviously on behalf of Black and Lavella. I want to start with, I thought there would be a lot more focus on Argentina today, but I do want to start with the purpose of the statute of 18015, because I think that's, it sounds like all your previous decisions go back to what the purpose is, which is to protect attorneys. The purpose of the statute is not to make it harder for attorneys to get paid, it's to make it easier for attorneys to get paid when they provide a valuable service. Going back to even the very earlier versions of the statute, going back to the early cases interpreting the statute, it says that the attorney should be able to get paid, and it says that the statute that creates an attorney's lien is a remedial statute and should be construed liberally to that end, consistent with what the legislature wanted. I understand that the first part of the argument is that there was no charging lien. And I think, in fact, every part of Dr. Leventhal's argument can be related to one section of 18015, which is very clear. It's a pretty easy statute to read. I think that the plain language controls. So to the extent that he's citing to cases that are either unpublished or that are not or that are not mandatory authority for this court, you can't look at those because the plain language of the statute controls. Pursuant to 18015.1, Black and Lavella did have a valid charging lien, pursuant to Section 1 of the statute, not only in our fee agreement, but by virtue of the statute itself, which is a statutory lien. Then pursuant to Section 2 of the statute, Black and Lavella perfected its lien by sending notice of the lien claimed to Dr. Leventhal, and it was done along with the motion to adjudicate the lien, but if you read Section 2 of the statute along with Section 4 of the statute, there is nowhere, and there is no case, any mandatory authority or published authority, that says that the notice and perfection must occur before the motion is filed. And the district court found that was the plain language of the statute and that Audie had cited no authority for that proposition. So I think that takes care of that. Just so you know, as far as the issue of whether or not there was proper service, and the district court found, and the district court had evidence to consider, that Audie was properly served. He was served at the same address, the Crossroads residence, that was the marital home identified in the marital settlement agreement. That property was awarded to him as of that date. It was the same address where every bill from my office, every communication with Audie was sent. It was also the address identified as where he received the notice of withdrawal and where he admits he received the notice of our eventual judgment, the lien that was granted by the district court. So, for him to argue...
I'm sorry to interrupt you, the video is difficult. Can you hear me all right?
Mrs. Pickering, would you please repeat your question?
Okay, evidently...
Justice Pickering, we're having some technical problems, I believe.
Justice, yes, evidently.
Yourself, please.
I was going to... Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
My question concerns 18015 sub 3. Which you've addressed the other subparagraphs, but in this case, would you not agree that no money or property was recovered after the time of service, even assuming service, in this case?
No, I disagree with that. Money, property was recovered because... Well, first of all, you've heard some incorrect assertions in counsel's argument, unfortunately. The parties decreed divorce and a merged marital settlement agreement did indeed cover both property and custody issues. Let's remember this gentleman, per the record, had...
But it has to be, under paragraph 3, the recovery needs to post-date notice of the lien.
The court shall have 5 days' notice. I'm sorry, under subsection 3?
Yes. The lien attaches to any money or property which is recovered on account of the suit or other action from the time of service of the notices.
No,
didn't you agree that there was no money or property recovered after the time you served your notice?
I disagree respectfully with both your interpretation of that subparagraph 3, and also...
But do you agree that, just factually, there was no property recovered after your lien was served?
No, I disagree with that. Because part of the last stipulation of order did not just deal with custody. The record is clear that they had financial agreements contained in that stipulation, which included Audie's right to receive information from his ex-wife so he could amend taxes and file taxes going forward, which obviously had a financial benefit, which is why he pursued that relief. So, yes, he was able to recover a financial benefit after that. And even if you read the statute the way that you're proposing, which I do agree, that's one interpretation, but that is not how I interpreted it. I know that's not how the district court interpreted it. I believe that that's basically saying that the lien attaches from the time of service. I think that it would still... It doesn't make any sense that an attorney wouldn't be able to lien property that was recovered before the date that they filed their motion. I don't think that's the intent of the statute at all.
So, would you be able to file this 5 years after the divorce?
5 years? I guess there wouldn't be anything under... No, there wouldn't be anything precluding that. That wouldn't be very good business. And I think it's very standard that attorneys, when a case is over, if they have recovered and their clients don't pay them, that they would seek to get a lien on that recovery. Does that answer your question?
It's responsive. I don't know if it answers my question.
I guess the answer then is that, yes, I think that an attorney could, up to 5 years after recovering something, a settlement, a monetary judgment, or any other property, that the statute does say judgment and property. So yes, if the client didn't pay, the attorney has the right per the statute to get a lien. And remember, when I have a judgment, that doesn't mean I'm going to go get the money that I recovered from my client. I still have to go out and execute and collect on the judgment. If I wait 5 years, the property may be long gone.
Mr. Bennell, I'd like to ask the question, unless the chief had, I interrupted the chief. I'd like to ask the question in a slightly different way. Again, focusing on subparagraph 3 of the statute. Without any question, the statute says the lien attaches to something from the time the notice is served. Would you agree that anything that has been recovered or paid or obtained before the notice has been served is not attached by the lien?
No, I would not agree with that. That's not
how. So how would we, in addressing this case, how would you construct the interpretation of subsection 3 in an opinion that addresses this case? How would you recommend the court address the interpretation of subsection 3 to avoid the interpretation I just suggested?
How I interpret it, Your Honor, is that the reading of subparagraph 3 is that the lien attaches to anything that was recovered in the suit or other action, okay? So
from the time of service of the notice. It seems to me that those are multiple components, all of which have to be satisfied. And what is interesting, just to finish my thought,
mm-hmm.
What concerns me is subparagraph 3 uses the word attaches, where subparagraph 2 uses the word perfects. Those are two different legal acts.
Right.
Would you agree?
Yeah, I agree with that.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So even though one may have perfected their lien, it only attaches to certain things by the statute.
That is one interpretation of what I guess is argued. I don't think it's a big
problem. Again, I'm not trying to arrive at a conclusion. I'm asking for guidance. I'm asking for you to articulate how the court would describe your interpretation, which I understand to mean that the lien attaches to everything that's obtained, even though the notice postdates that. And in this case, postdates the decree. Here, I think the issue might be different. If the notice had been made before the decree was entered, then perhaps there wouldn't be any question at all. It seems to me you get what you get at the time of the decree. But here we have a notice that postdates the decree.
And so, it postdates the judgment as well, the stipulation from January 7, 2011.
Right.
But just, I guess it doesn't make a difference, but remember that modified the MSA, and that's the MSA and decree are fully integrated agreements.
Right.
So really, that you're looking at that date. You're looking at the date of January 7th. But I don't think that the statute was intended that if you don't seek to adjudicate your attorney lien before your client walks into court and submits a stipulated settlement and order, and then the attorney is foreclosed from recovering from anything.
Well, adjudicating the lien is quite yet another separate act from the notice that perfects and the notice that attaches. So I don't dispute your point that you might file a motion many months later under the statute to prosecute a judgment or obtain a judgment in aid of the perfected and attached lien. The question for the judge is what did it attach to? That's what I'm trying to understand under subparagraph 3. What did your lien attach to and why?
Our lien attached to all property recovered for him as a result of both the decree. Remember, it's one action. It was a divorce action, which dealt with both custody and property.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, eventually we upheld the premarital agreement and recovered him that property. We dealt with the custody, but then post decree, we went back and clarified and amended the decree in that January stipulation. So to answer your question, our lien attached to everything that was recovered from the decree of divorce, which, as I stated, because that was an integrated agreement, the marital settlement agreement was an integrated agreement, would have still been a recovery as of the day we...
What acts did the parties have to perform post-decree that would transfer property to one another? I'm assuming that post-decree, and I haven't heard you say this, but I'm inferring that because the parties had to do some things under the decree after the decree was entered, they had to sign deeds or write checks or endorse something. Were there acts here that actually resulted in the transfers of property?
Well, the physical transfer of the Crossroads residence where we served Audie, that property was awarded to him as part of the decree in the MSA. However, the plaintiff, his ex-wife Jacqueline, had exclusive possession of that, so he got to take possession of that post-decree. So that would be one example.
Was there a deed that transferred in which she quit claimed her interest?
Yes. I don't want to speak out of turn because I believe the residence was never in her name. And so whether or not Audie, subsequent to the divorce, had her sign something, sometimes litigants do that out of an abundance of caution.
On the properties that were exchanged under the MSA and the decree, were there any checks written, deeds written?
Yes, there were checks written subsequent to the decree. There was a lump sum payment to Jacqueline. Then Audie paid some of her attorney's fees and some of the investment accounts, I believe, had to have money transferred from Audie to Jacqueline, some of his investments.
But the money all went from Mr. Leventhal to his ex-wife, not the other direction, correct?
Correct, other than there was some property, personal property, that was returned by Jacqueline to Audie.
If you put this in a regular, like a conventional personal injury context where plaintiff A sues defendant B for $100,000 for personal injury and the plaintiff's lawyer puts a notice of lien on the file, if the defendant wants to pay the $100,000 and he gives it directly to the plaintiff, this lien would be good against that payment. But if it's put on record and perfected after the defendant has made the payment, you can't go back against the defendant for the money that he paid out from under your lien because your lien never attached. That's how I read the statute. And I apologize so much for the poor audio. I'm just sick that this is not going better. Do you see what I'm saying?
I do, but I guess I think that there are other cases that hold that if the money had been transferred, as in your example, Justice, that attorney,
yes,
if he already had his lien, he would be able to pursue that against the party that the money was transferred to.
Against his client, but you're saying the lien would not be good against the other party, the defendant?
Now, there is case law that says the lien would be good against the defendant.
Pays it with no lien of record?
Pardon me?
The defendant who settles and there's no lien of record? You're saying you could go back and retroactively assert a lien?
No. I'm saying if you had a lien and then the property was transferred.
Yeah, absolutely. But if you don't have a lien until after the defendant pays to settle the suit, you can't go against the defendant.
Right. I agree with that. And I see why you're asking.
So why would that not be the same thing here?
I'm sorry, I interrupted you, Justice.
My question is, why doesn't that model apply here where you have a fully performed divorce decree, whatever it is, and the case is over before the lien is put of record? I'm not sure what the court has got jurisdiction over.
Well, it wasn't fully performed because there were additional financial acts based, that had to be performed based on the order from January of 2011, which included...
And those had to do with filing the tax return?
Correct.
Anything else?
Which was going to be able to... No. No, and the plaintiff agreed to... I'm sorry, the defendant agreed to forego receiving some of the child's clothes. I mean, those are minor things, but the main issue was that he wanted to be able to go back and amend his tax returns, which would have a financial benefit to him, and that was part of our eventual order that we stipulated to.
Okay.
There is a financial benefit to him that postdates my lien, our lien.
You also mentioned the return of personal property. Was that personal property delivered after your notice was served?
I have no idea, but it was on a waiving return of personal property. He was supposed to get a third of Asher's clothing, my child, and in the stipulation, he agreed to waive that, so Jackie could keep those. So there was
property you're referring to is nominal.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, returning the justice, the Chief Justice is hypothetical. If in a personal injury action, a judgment is returned, and the counsel serves notice post-judgment of the lien, and there has been no payment, and the payment thereafter is paid. Isn't that the purpose of subsection 3, to attach to the judgment even though it hasn't been paid?
No, I disagree that that's the purpose.
Okay.
The purpose, and I believe there's a very broad interpretation because it says the lien attaches to any verdict, judgment, or decree entered, and to any money or property which is recovered on account of the suit.
What do you do with the words from the time of service?
What do you mean, what do I do with the word?
The words from the time of service measure when the attachment occurs.
Correct. The lien.
Okay.
That just has to do with when the lien attaches.
Okay.
Can I have 2 more minutes or another minute or two just to summarize?
Yeah, 1 minute to conclude.
Okay, thank you. Again, I just wanted to make the point that the Argentina decision and the idea that there is no property here that could be attached by the lien. Argentina is a very fact-specific decision. There was no counterclaim filed in that case. In our case, we had a counterclaim. There was no malpractice claim asserted in that case, as there was, which I think is a big factor in Argentina. It just didn't seem right for the district court to be able to just give them that $230,000+ judgment. I don't think that you need to disturb Argentina in this case to come up with the right result, which is that the work was performed, there was a recovery for Dr. Leventhal, and our lien should attach to that. It should, like I said, the statutes, the case law says they are remedial in nature and they need to be broadly construed. And so I would respectfully request that the court confirm the order of the district court, both the judgment that was entered in favor of Black and Lavello, as well as the order of decision denying the 60B motion to set aside. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lavello. Mr. Crockman.
Thank you, Justices. Has really focused in on what we're talking about here correctly. Lavello's argument is that it all sort of is pushed together and all together. The notice of lien, the attachment, the perfection, and then the implementation of all those at once. In fact, that's not how the statute reads. Under Section 2, you perfect your lien. And you do that by giving proper notice. That perfection then attaches at that time to whatever judgment or proceeds from the recovery may exist later, even when you get a judgment. But in this case, the notice of lien was the very last thing done after all the cases were settled, after all the cases were done, after all property was distributed. And I think we heard counsel first state that property was given to Mr. Lowenthal and then stated, no, no, it was a waiver.
Well, I'm not so sure, Mr. Kaufman. I don't read subparagraph 2, which relates to the perfection of the lien, as setting a time requirement for service of the notice. It says the attorney perfects the lien by serving notice in writing. Didn't say when.
Well, the case law...
Isn't perfection of the lien a different circumstance than what it attaches to?
Yes, they're two different things. The problem is that, well, first of all, the precedent, Argentina, for instance, and Shuck, for instance, they all state that you have to have a proceeds to attach to. So if you don't...
I'm asking only about perfection. Let's just stick with perfection.
Okay.
Do you agree that subparagraph 2 allows one to perfect their lien by serving a notice, regardless of when they send it?
Regardless of when they send it?
Yeah.
If notice is proper, but in... Yes.
I know you dispute the validity or invalidity.
Yes, Your Honor.
Let's assume for purposes of this question.
That's what subsection says.
Notice given was proper.
Yes, if it's served in the proper way, strictly construed as to subsection 2.
So isn't the issue here how one interprets subparagraph 3, what the now perfected lien attaches to?
In addition to the malpractice issues and the notice issues and due process.
We'll get into that in a minute. Okay. I have a question about that. But do you agree that if the lien is perfected by notice, regardless of when given, then the only remaining question is what it attaches to?
Correct. And in Argentina and the precedent, if there's no assets recovery, then it can't attach to anything, which is subsection 3. Mm-hmm. And that's why...
So you're saying that in any case in which the attorney is defending a party where the primary issue in dispute is the defense of his or her separate property, and counsel is successful and the other spouse obtains nothing in the separate property, there's nothing to charge?
No, I think that what you have to do is you have to serve, you have to perfect your notice prior to withdrawing, prior to settling the case. Then you may, which attaches, and then you may adjudicate. But if you don't do your notice of lien, if you don't perfect it until after everything's done, well, now the case is over, there's any withdrawn. So you could essentially, under that theory, go back in perpetuity, 5 years, 10 years, and say, oh, I'm going to file my notice of lien now and go and attach and get a divorce property 10 years earlier.
But you don't dispute what I think was the answer to Justice Hardesty's question, and that is that indeed, assuming all of the criteria for notice and perfection, etc., service, etc., have been made, that indeed, in a divorce situation, the lien could attach to even property that was just preserved in the distribution of assets as between the two parties. It doesn't have to be some other type of... If my husband and I are fighting over my share of this piece of property and his attorney succeeds in letting me retain all of it, you don't deny that a lien could attach to all of that property.
The retainer, yes. I can make that more clear. Once the property has been dispersed, no, you don't get to perfect and attach. But if that property has not yet been dispersed, or not, it's still somewhere in a trust, or it's somewhere yet to be adjudicated by a court, then I believe possibly, yes. I don't think those are the facts in this case, because we don't have proper notice under 18.01.
No, we don't have to focus our questions with assuming that was clear.
I have one final question, sure. If I may. Mr. Kaufman, is there anything in the lien statute that says, or any interpretation from these various provisions in your mind that says, that a lawyer who withdraws from a case with a perfected lien can pursue the collection of that lien.
There's nothing expressly in this statute that says that, Your Honor. That would come from the case law, Your Honor. And if you filed and perfected a proper notice of lien and it attaches to property, now you're sitting pretty good, given that everything else is in compliance. The problem in this case, of course, is we don't have
again, I'm trying to look at this more holistic. And I recognize the facts of this case may be slightly different, but that said, a lawyer who perfects the lien, maybe even gives notice and attaches before settlement or judgment, and then withdraws, do you see anything in that statute that precludes the withdrawing lawyer from suing to obtain collection of the lien?
In the statute, I don't, because it doesn't deal with voluntary withdrawal, Your Honor. However, having read the case law, the issue is when you were discharged, because it was not a voluntary withdrawal, you maintain your lien. There is an issue of personal jurisdiction because the attorney is no longer a counsel of record if they voluntarily withdraw, especially in this case where there's no notice at all. Yeah. And there's no more questionable situation. But when an attorney's been discharged, they maintain their lien. If properly done.
Could you comment on your opposing colleague's argument that there was benefit generated post-withdrawal due to their representation to which this lien could attach?
Justice, I would just disagree. And I haven't seen any evidence in the record that shows that whatsoever. In addition, there's a malpractice claim, but I haven't seen, directly to your question, I haven't seen anything in the record that shows that. The divorce was back in May of 2010. It was adjudicated. I think opposing counsel just stated that the only personal property that was at issue was merely a waiver by Ali, but he actually didn't get any property.
Thank you. This matter will stand submitted. The court will be in recess until its next call.